Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Daniel Buckner from Microsoft to discuss their recent announcement that Microsoft is using the Bitcoin blockchain to create decentralized identities. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So BlockFi, hooked up with them this week, caught up with the team, found out about all the interesting things that are coming up, which is super cool. And they've also just confirmed that they're going to be extending their sponsorship with the podcast for the fourth time. So I want to just say a massive thank you to the whole team at BlockFi for supporting the podcast for so long. I do love this company. I love the way that they are creating the future of Bitcoin financial services. And with BlockFi, you can earn interest on your crypto with their interest accounts, and you can also borrow against your crypto holdings. And also, they've got a bunch of exciting new products coming this year, which I mentioned before, and I will be telling you about on the show. So if you're interested in trying out BlockFi, you want to try out their interest accounts or their loans products, then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. That is BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Next up is Dropbit, my newest sponsor who sponsored my party in New York. Thanks, guys. Thanks for that. This is the best Bitcoin wallet I've found, and it's the simplest way to send and receive Bitcoin. It's kind of like Venmo for Bitcoin. It's just such an easy way to send Bitcoin to other people. And I love it for the simple and amazing UX they've created. You can even text Bitcoin to your friends using a mobile phone number. It's available on iPhone and Android. So if you want to go and try it out, head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. That is dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And Aurox, for all you hardcore traders out there, the world's best crypto trading terminal, which is available on both Macs and PCs. Using your APIs, you can trade on up to 9 exchanges, including Kraken, and you can create advanced order types directly in the software. There's a trade feed, which is curated from the best professionals to help you with your research, and you can set up alerts from a list of over 150 indicators. Aurox can even handle custom indicators written in PineScript or JavaScript. They've got a 14-day free trial. Just head over to getaurox.com, which is GetAurox.com. That's getaurox.com, which is GetAurox.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Daniel, and this one has been in the planning for a while. I've been talking to Daniel for a few weeks about this, and as our paths were going to cross at Consensus, Daniel agreed to come on the podcast and discuss the announcement that Microsoft is creating decentralized identities using the Bitcoin blockchain. I had a whole bunch of questions for Daniel around this. Firstly, just because the announcement's super cool, the fact that a company the size of Microsoft is getting involved in Bitcoin is amazing, but also because I wanted to understand about how these decentralized identities work in the real world. Daniel explains to me how the culture at Microsoft has changed, why they're using the Bitcoin blockchain to solve this problem, and how these decentralized identities will work. As ever, if you've got any questions about this interview, do feel free to reach out to me. And listen, if you enjoy the podcast, if you want to support what I do, then there's a section on my website that explains everything. Head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section. And I also need to say a massive thank you to my top tier patron, Rise Wallet. Met up with them in New York. They are a new way into Bitcoin. There are no signups. You just scan a card and you are holding Bitcoin. To find out more, head over to risewallet.com. Okay, hope you enjoy the interview. You got any questions? Then you know you can get hold of me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Good. Doing all right.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. Obviously, we've spoken for a couple of weeks about this, and it's been quite exciting to get you on. And you've obviously had a huge announcement today, which we will come to. But I want to know how a voluntarist libertarian ends up at Microsoft.
Well, you know, it started at Mozilla before Microsoft. I was at Mozilla for about 5 years and, you know, really accepting culture there in a lot of ways. But I was surprised at how accepting folks at Microsoft were. It's a really mature work environment. And kind of as long as you do the work, it doesn't seem like they much mind, you know, who you are as a person, which I thought was really cool. So there's a really diverse work group, and I've never been, you know, anything but accepted. So I was a little surprised too, but that's how it is. So,
what is your background? Like, what led you up to being kind of, I guess you're a little bit of a, well, you say you're a libertarian, but you're obviously a Bitcoiner as well.
Yeah. I first bought Bitcoin in 2011. I had a buddy that sat next to me at Mozilla, and he was more into it than I was. And, you know, I just kind of got into it because of him. And he said, hey, you know, it's this cool system. And, you know, all the things we always talk about, because, you know, we talked about economics a lot. It has all these attributes. And so I picked up, I was like the dumb libertarian who actually believed in all of the underlying principles, you know, store of value type stuff. And I did not buy a bunch. I bought like a paltry amount to play with the technology, like literally. And, you know, enough that I'm like, you know, it was cool having a little bit extra money, but nothing like, you know, in the riches. So I was really interested in it primarily for those reasons, like the actual technology, what it was capable of, even beyond money. And I kind of recognized that early on. And that's been what I've tried to work on for my, you know, most of my career since then.
And what is your job at Microsoft?
So I'm a product person who works on the open source side of what we do, which is most stuff. So everything we do in relation to decentralized identity, most of it is open source. We're doing that through the Decentralized Identity Foundation. That's at identity.foundation. And that's basically an open source patent-free group, operates under the same IPR as W3C, and everything's under Apache 2. And so the crux of my work is trying to kind of realize some of the things that I've wanted to build for a long, long time. And it just so happens that Microsoft, their interests are aligned for this new form of identity we call decentralized identity for various reasons.
And within Microsoft, you talked about this is part of the open source team or department. Open source hasn't always been something Microsoft has, you know, supported or been part of. There's been a real transition in where the company directs its resources, where it makes its income now, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Yeah, for many years, back, you know, in the 90s and early aughts, Microsoft was definitely not embracing open source the way they are today. I think in the last 5 to 10 years, that's turned around completely. Like for a while, I believe we were the number one contributor to Linux. We're still in the top like three, you know, in terms of open source contributing orgs, if not number one. So for a lot of years, I think they've done the right thing across the board. And I think just recently under Satya, really Satya has been transformative, and I mean, he really does do what he says. So it's not just in word, but you can actually tell in the company the way that people act is in accordance with the things that he's saying externally. It's turned around completely. Like I feel like we're thinking open first in so many more areas. And I think that's going to be hugely beneficial to the company in the long run, and hopefully to everyone else out there who uses the stuff we build.
So has that been a huge cultural shift within Microsoft?
I think it's really group to group. With certain groups, you knew they were always, they actually had an open source org, so we still have one. And you know, obviously they understand it very clearly. But every product group and division kind of operate a little bit differently. Like some were a little bit more closed source, maybe they just weren't exposed to needing open source stuff. So that, you know, it takes a little bit when people don't have that muscle built to get them into that. And I was really familiar with that, obviously, at Mozilla, because that's all we did. So when I came in, it was, you know, it was a little bit of enculturating people to that new way of thinking.
Right, okay. All right, well, listen, let's get into the announcement, because it's kind of a big deal. I mean, just the name Microsoft alongside Bitcoin is a big deal, but actually what you're doing is really important. So do you want to just explain the announcement?
Yeah, so, you know, in this larger effort, decentralized identity, what we want to make possible is for people to own all aspects of their identity and control really sensitive information in their lives, something that we just don't have today, that we've lost really on the web. The web has kind of centralized over time. And we see this as a series of components that we're going to try and help deliver in collaboration with others. That's from everywhere from the identifiers you use, which is the topic of the announcement, to how you store and encrypt your data and how you exchange it with people in privacy-preserving ways. So this announcement is really centers on the identifier portion. So we've been working for a while with a number of individuals in the Decentralized Identity Foundation, the W3 Credentials Community Group, and with other, you know, people that consult us on occasion, like Christopher Allen, on the principles of DID. This new thing called DIDs, Decentralized Identifiers, it's a spec in the W3C. It basically sets out a format and a kind of a framework for creating IDs that are owned by you as a person. So today we have email addresses and we have usernames, things like that. They're given to you by companies. And those companies, whether for, you know, purposeful or you know, reasons like they just shut down or they want to eliminate you from the platform, they can take those whenever they want. And, you know, right now your data is, you know, that you might lose is your cat pics on Facebook or something like that. But if we really look forward and we have true identity proofs, things that are really important to your lives baked into identifiers that could be just eliminated at any moment for any number of reasons, that's a little bit scary. You know, you talk about being deplatformed, but it's a whole other thing when the IDs themselves are the carriers of really, really important information. So what we are announcing, and we announced earlier today, is an identifier protocol, I would say spiritually akin to Lightning. Not, it's very different technically. It's not payment channels or anything like that. But it's a layer two. It's trustless. Microsoft isn't a signatory. There's no validators. There's no special protocol tokens required to operate it. It's really just, you know, deterministic software that you can run right on top of Bitcoin. Uses an underlying protocol that is chain agnostic, but this one's adapted for Bitcoin. And I'll point out that there are groups in other communities like Ethereum, Transmute being the lead in that area, that are adapting it for Ethereum. And so Microsoft, you know, we're supporting this Bitcoin variant. We're supportive of the other ones as well. But I think the point to get across from us is that we really want the outcome of decentralized identifiers. And that's what we're wanting to back. And I think that that is really these public permissionless networks. And they were good at this thing that makes decentralized identifiers possible since the moment Satoshi flicked the switch.
What is the interest for Microsoft in doing this?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, like economically, we don't derive our money from the same sources as some of our competitors. It's highly diversified. It's across a range of products. Those products are typically thought of as yours anyway. So we want a world where people can own their own data, where they can be the masters of that domain. And for us, we see actually a ton of benefit that's, it's not just all altruistic. It's there, you know, there's some corporate interest there. Like, just think about if, you know, the data in certain networks became more trustable, right? There's LinkedIn. It'd be great if you knew that someone actually did go to school at a certain place, right? Or, you know, with certain interactions with Airbnb, that, you know, there was a health code check or a structural check on the house, and you can actually relay that in, you know, digital means that are instantly verifiable. That's what these IDs make possible. And we think that because we're already an enterprise identity company, if we empowered users and corporations and companies with that sort of identity system, we can start making money in new ways, right, with these services that are built on top.
And thinking in terms of the user, yeah. Do you envisage a scenario, you know, when you're going to sign up to a website and you've got all the different options, you can sign up with your email or use Facebook login. Do you see there being this additional option that exists, which will be some form of decentralized identity?
That is what we're gearing up for, right? So we're working with W3C, which is the standardization body for pretty much anything that touches a web browser or web interaction. And we are going to be working to have decentralized identifiers, the generic spec, you know, something that W3C, you know, passes through its processes and gets ratified. And then also things like proof of control or authentication, as some people might call it, where you can, you know, prove that you own an identifier to a website or an app, and they allow you access not based on some centralized username they provide you or some federated, you know, email-based system, but an identifier that you solely control.
Okay, and is it something that you guys at Microsoft will build, or are you giving people the tools to build it themselves?
I think it's a mixture of that and other things that other folks will build based on these standards. So we're not taking the approach that, you know, all tools are going to come from us. In fact, that it wouldn't be healthy. I think that we are going to support a subset of the open source components necessary to sort of seed this new identity layer. But we're also working with other folks that, you know, even competitors, because in this in strange world of decentralized identity, no one wins identity, right? Or then it wouldn't matter, right? So we're not trying to win. We're just trying to make sure that it exists. It's kind of like we're interested in making really great phone calls and sending information over the telephone lines. So we're going to try and help put up the telephone poles and the wire, you know? That's kind of the position we're in.
I guess, though, at the same time, we don't want to get to a stage where we go to a website and there's 50 different options for identity.
So DIDs themselves, the DID spec and the proof of control authentication stuff that we're going to work on, which we hope to be an open standard as well, just like OAuth and, you know, FIDO are today, will make it not, it's not going to be NASCAR badges. It'll be login with your DID. And whether you choose to root your identifier in ION, which is the, you know, the method that we launched today that runs on the Bitcoin blockchain is layer two, or other methods like Transmute's Elements, which is based on Ethereum, or Sovereign, whatever you as the user decide, whatever trust basis, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum or Sovereign, that's up to you. And you don't see those names, you just see login with your decentralized ID.
I guess in some ways this is a very different model from a Google login or a Facebook login, whereby they monetize the data that's associated with your login. Are you essentially causing them a problem with this?
Well, I mean, I hope not, right? I hope that as good corporate citizens that we can all agree that it's a better world when people have control of their data, how they use it, who's seeing it, and do that in a way that's clear, open and transparent. And so anyone who can get on board with those attributes, I think we're aligned with. If folks don't, I think it's the impetus is on them to ask them the question why, right? Why wouldn't you be okay with that? And I'm not saying that they aren't. I with open arms, hope that they embrace this technology, because I think it's just good for people. And I do think that you can still make money. I think you have to just do it in slightly different ways, and you have to be maybe a little bit more upfront about certain things. But I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I think Facebook might be slightly different, because they recently announced that they've got to have a higher focus on privacy. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the future of their business probably is in maybe financial products, less so in adverts in the timeline, because less people using Facebook. But Facebook being Facebook will want to do their own thing. I think obviously Google's slightly different, but one of the other things about Google is I tried to remove all my like identifiable data and to use Google, and actually the experience degrades if they don't know anything about me or where I am. Mm-hmm. As well. So part of that controlling the data that you share with a platform is going to be important.
Oh yeah, so I don't think that sharing data is bad, right? Joe Andrews, he is a guy that works in the Rebooting Web of Trust circle that Chris Allen helped start up. And that's like a, sort of this event you can come to, happens twice a year before IOW. He's written up this, some thoughts around how data is rights. It's not property, it's rights. And you should still be able to exercise your rights, right? Like I should still be able to say in a privacy preserving way that doesn't disclose I'm Dan as a person, like maybe my shoe size if I'm shopping for shoes or certain preferences. Like I want to do that, because if I don't do that, I'm going to end up seeing a bunch of shoes that I don't care about.
Yeah.
So I think it's about how we get to the same answer. Maybe we don't need to give our entire life away to find the right shoes. Maybe we just need to give really targeted values that preserve our privacy and we can get the same outcomes. And I think that's what businesses need to start being comfortable with, is not having this giant fire hose of random stuff to try and do isolated exchanges. It's more specific, it's more privacy preserving exchanges.
And I think privacy is a real hot topic at the moment for people. And it's a really important thing, especially with regards to the web. You know, we have data hacks, we have various things that are tracking us, which can get quite sinister at times. I guess I've noticed there's a want from it, but I think one of the things that's been a problem is that most people can't be bothered to do the work to manage their privacy. It needs to be led by a company like Microsoft to actually give us the tools, maybe automate it.
Yeah, so we're definitely going to put tools in users' hands that make this easier, because you're right. I mean, these are, at its base, these are incredibly arcane protocol exchanges, things that if you were left to your own devices with those raw bits, no user, certainly not, my mom is going to be able to jump in and use this thing. So companies do have to make wallets, and they have to make means of recovery in terms of like secrets and all of the things that still plague cryptocurrency. It's the same here, right? Your IDs are controlled by these keys, and you need to maintain those things. So I totally, I definitely think that companies like Microsoft are essential in stepping in here and kind of up-leveling those experiences so that they can, really reach a broad base. But that's not to say that Microsoft's going to be the only one, nor should they be. All of the things that we would bake into our wallet, many of them anyway, are standards-based protocols and formats that other groups can go make wallets around as well. So it's really about picking what's the experience that's best for you, that helps you manage this best. And you'll have, we hope, a wide selection.
I find a lot of the talk about Web3 kind of interesting. I recently read the Multicoin report and their mega thesis, and they talk about Web3. And I kind of try and think back to when I had my web agency, and we kind of went from 1 to 2, but it always felt like a retrospective. We look back and said, we're in this new era now of kind of fluid web pages and social data. And it was like an experience we look back on. As people try and predict Web3, which they've done many times, I find that a little bit strange, because I don't think we'll know what it will be. But I do see that we will potentially look back as a retrospective on Web3 and say privacy was central, control of our data was central, and that's the only component of Web3 I keep hearing about that I agree with.
Yeah, so, I mean, stepping into my personal views of how this Web3 thing could shape up, one future is that you imagine you have these decentralized identifiers, right? And you don't just have one identifier. Do you want to get that across, right? Whether it's rooted in Bitcoin or Ethereum or anywhere else, you shouldn't just have one. That's obviously highly correlatable. So we believe in this idea of pairwise or private identifiers where I could meet you for the first time and I could create a new identifier there on the spot. And that's kind of our conduit, our relationship. You know me through that. You can store data with me in accordance with it. We can have signed messages between it. And it doesn't leak that I might have 10 other identifiers that I use in other connections and circles. So that's a foundation. But once you nail the identifier layer, which is this ion, you know, for our, you know, contribution is this ion method that will run on top of Bitcoin. There's several other types of DID methods. Once you nail that, the next question is, well, you know, identifiers and keys can only do so much. So where's the Web3 thing come in? And I actually do think it is identity. And here's the next step. Basically, when you look up one of these identifiers, you get this JSON document. And it's got some key, public keys in it that are associated with DID. And it also has some off-chain endpoints. And we believe that one of these endpoints, or a few, could be instances of your personal encrypted data store that essentially, just think about it like a personal mesh that replicates data between it just for you. The data is encrypted. So even if Microsoft hosted it or Google or anyone, the data is encrypted. Like, they're not seeing and tracking all the things you do. And that is where the interface is for potentially apps and other interactions that are high value Web3 type interactions. I might look up your identifier, find where your data store is, and I send you a ping over that. And that ends up on your phone because it's hard to contact phones directly. So a lot of Web3 could actually end up just being interaction between these IDs and these data store relays. And I'll give you a couple examples, right? When people talk about decentralizing things, you have secondhand markets where people post classifieds. Right now, you go to one company and you kind of post something, it goes in their SQL database, and that's it. In the future, you might be able to create a DID and you could post something in your data store, which is crawlable if you allow, right? If you say this is a public thing I want people to see, it's possible to crawl these ID landscapes and then find that same information. So you could have a small company that sort of crawls this decentralized identity web, finds all those same things you would see on, you know, some local shopping or classified things, and present you a UI. Looks exactly the same, but what it wasn't was having to have you go and give them a copy of your information. And I think that same model can be applied in many areas. It could be ride sharing. It could end up being, Airbnb style stuff, or even things like supply chains. And that, because all of these things really resolve down to expressions of information and trust, and that's coming from the identity layer.
Is there a possibility that through the interactions on certain, say, websites, so for example, if it was Airbnb and you registered and logged in with your decentralized ID, at the point that you're creating a transaction and you're having to enter details about yourself, does that mean they will be able to actually just create new versions of data records to identify you?
Well, I think that we would hope in the fullness of time that if DIDs are a supported medium of identity in the broader web, that you might hit a site like that and you would disclose, you know, this is my DID, and you get the minimal amount of information possible. In some cases, in some interactions, maybe there is a lot of information required because it's by law or something like that, right? But hopefully it's minimized. Like, I don't need to disclose my full age. I can disclose that I'm over a certain age threshold, or I don't need to disclose my exact bank account. You just need to know I have 10,000 or more in the bank. Those are the sorts of proofs that you should be able to provide in those flows. And that's kind of what we're looking for.
But could there be a case where these companies are storing that information locally?
It could be, but the proofs, there's also, you know, depending on the scheme you use to create like such a proof, you can obscure their ability to kind of pass off that, you know, it's this is ID that they got it from was related to me, Daniel, as the person. We're starting into the phase of doing a lot of work on that. Like, after you get the identifier set, system set, then it comes to like, well, how do we sign proofs with these keys and these identifiers, and what types of proofs can we create? So that's an area of work that we have just, we've explored it already, but we're getting into it, more seriously now.
What will the user experience be like for the user? Have you done the planning on there?
So it's an app model. I can't talk too much about it because this is something that we're kind of working on now. So I can just tell you that, yes, it needs to be a friendly application that is on the devices that, are common to users today. And it has to not, maybe they never even see the word DID, right? Maybe that's not a thing. Maybe they just, they're signing in via some gesture or some mechanism with their phone that feels a little bit natural, that doesn't have to inform them about the obscene complexity behind the scenes, right? That's I think, what a lot of people are looking to do. And so that's I'm guessing, the way that we'd go.
But if there's an interaction with a blockchain, so for example, the Bitcoin blockchain to create the identifier, will they have to pay that fee?
In my estimation, no. And here's why. Because the protocol ION, or the DID method ION that we've announced, it's based on another underlying protocol called SideTree that is similar to like these anchoring schemes you've seen for a long time. But it's a little different. So it does allow you high volumes of operations can be batched together, and they are anchored with a hash, just like other protocols. The special part comes in with what the nodes do that see those operational batches on the IPFS substrate, and they fetch them and process them. Think about this. Like, if Bitcoin went up to $10 a transaction, if there was 30,000 high-value DID operations for numerous users in that payload, the question becomes, to add a key to your ID that may unlock some really, really great experiences for you, are you willing to pay 1/30,000th of $10? Probably, right? That's probably a rounding error. Companies like Microsoft, if we ran one of these nodes, which we can, and you don't have to trust us because all the operations are signed on your local client, right? You're just trusting us to batch them. We wouldn't charge anything because for us, that's a rounding error. Right, it really is. And for most companies of any size, it's a rounding error. So I think they will be highly aggregated. I don't think the average user will have to pay. I think that you'll always have the ability to do it without a company doing it, right? It's just, it's a open source node, so you could always run one yourself, and you could, you know, if you want to have maximum censorship resistance and you don't even trust sending one of these ops, which Microsoft can't manipulate in any way, just the only thing we'd be able to do is not publish it, right? If you don't trust us or anyone else like that, you could just do it yourself. The reality is, like, most people's ops are never, ever, ever going to get denied by any reasonable company. So we think it's going to be pretty economically scalable.
Right, so you would be covering the cost of the mining fee.
Yeah, expected. That's the idea going forward. Yeah.
And are there any kind of risks that in the future, years down the line, where Bitcoin is used extensively, there's so many transactions going into the blockchain that fees go really high. Is that any kind of risk in the future?
I absolutely think it is. It is. So we're not naive about that, right? Fees at a certain level with this protocol are acceptable. Over an extreme level, probably not. But there are other options how we can evolve the protocol over time. Some of those things that people have done good work in the sidechain space and other stuff like that, you know, we started this in a simple fashion because we wanted to use just the consensus of Bitcoin itself and its linear chronological ordering capability as the consensus instead of going and adding another layer of consensus or another chain that we have to start, because without people really deeply into this protocol and working on it, it would end up just probably being one company running some random system off to the side. I would rather have that conversation with the community to show it working over a number of years. And if Bitcoin got so popular, thankfully, yeah, right, that we can evolve how we do things. And we're completely open to that. But, it's like, let's get to that good problem first of having Bitcoin and open public systems be so darn, important and often used that we have to even talk about it.
Next up, I talked to Daniel Moore about how these decentralized identities work. But before that, I got a message from my show sponsors. So Kraken, the best exchange in the world for buying and selling digital assets. And it's the only place I use to buy and sell Bitcoin from now. The exchange I trust more than any, mostly due to their focus on security, something that we all should care about as exchanges are still getting hacked. They can support simple buy-in for the new traders, but they have advanced tools for the more experienced traders out there, including margin trading and futures trading. They've got no high minimum and hidden fees. Kraken rewards you for trading so you can make more trades for less, and they've got over 70 asset pairs. If you want to join me in supporting Kraken, the best crypto asset exchange in the world, head over to kraken.com, which is kraken.com. That is kraken.com, which is kraken.com. So BlockFi, as I mentioned, I hooked up with the team this week, found out about some interesting things that are coming out this year. Can't wait to tell you about those. I also moderated a lending panel at Consensus, which included Zach Prince from BlockFi, but some of their competitors. I think the video is available somewhere. I'll try and dig it out, but if you want to check that out, that was super interesting. And they've also confirmed they're going to carry on with the sponsorship of the podcast, which is great. So big thanks to the team there. I love how they're creating the future of crypto and financial services, the products that are coming, which allow us to do more with our crypto. So two main products they've got right now: interest accounts for your crypto deposits, and borrowing against your crypto holdings. If you're interested in finding out more about these products, head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. That is BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Are there any ethical considerations with using the Bitcoin blockchain for non-financial transactions? And is there any risk where, okay, so you've got this initiative, but a whole number of other initiatives start using the Bitcoin blockchain, but not for Bitcoin transactions? Is there any ethical considerations about that? Or have you had any conversation with people they believe, no, the Bitcoin blockchain should only be for Bitcoin transactions and not for other data?
Oh, absolutely. You run into those folks. Most people I talk to are like, look, man, it's a valid transaction if you pay the fee. And in fact, the protocol actually incentivizes higher fee payment. So I'm pretty sure the miners are going to like it from that perspective, right? Abnormally high fee payment, I guess you could say. There are people that believe that that transactions sent without the intent to deliver money from entity one to entity two are like not valid Bitcoin transactions. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, what we're talking about is a trust layer that doesn't require centralized actors. And that's exactly what identity needs. It needs the strongest trust layer, and that's these open public blockchains, period. There's been nothing like it before. And to say that money is incredibly important. I really think it's money and identity personally, because if you don't have decentralized money, someone controls your money, you lose your paycheck. If you don't have decentralized identity, someone controls your identity, you may not be able to function in society in many, many areas, right? Independent of money. So I think that it's equally as important as money, and I'd be willing to have that debate with people out in the open in the community.
Yeah, I guess the only fear I would have is that if the blocks got full of non-transaction data and they were slowing the blocks down or people were unable to get transactions through, yeah, that would be my only concern, but I wouldn't have any idea how much data would have to be written to a block for it to become a problem.
Not a lot. I mean, this protocol can be highly efficient. I mean, we're talking about like, you know, tens of thousands of operations packed into one transaction, even potentially scaling it beyond that. I think that at single-digit percentage consumption of the Bitcoin blockchain, we would be able to support all of humanity's IDs. And okay. So if we got to that problem and we're like, oh gosh, we're eating like single-digit percentages of Bitcoin, but we've supported humanity on, you know, a decentralized identity system. And I'm not saying that this is going to be the only decentralized identity system for our other collaborators working out there on, you know, like standards-based versions. More power to you, and that's, you know, we're going to support you. But the system should be capable of that without undue weight on the chain.
I kind of agree with you in that decentralized money and decentralized identity are great problems to solve, but they also feel like they go hand in hand.
They really do. I mean, there's a lot of places you can't, it doesn't matter if you're using Bitcoin or you're using like, you know, the good old US paper dollar. A lot of places require you prove identity things before you can actually even give them any money, right? So sometimes identity is the gate to certain activities, for better or for worse, I should say. I was on Andreas's podcast and he was talking about the for worse parts of maybe we should require as little identity as possible, which I completely agree with. But the reality is that there's going to be places in life where they do require it. And so having as much power on both sides of the equation of your value in your pocket and your identity that you control, I think is that perfect marriage.
Are there any new models or workflows or opportunities that this creates that can't exist without decentralized identity?
Oh, absolutely. So I think that many of the services, the market type services we see today, they're centralized because you need centralized bid-ask coordinators and people to sort of like, you know, hook up different entities to do a deal. And I think that once you have this crawlable decentralized identity layer full of pseudonymous identifiers that can be optionally linked to people if they want to disclose that, you can start doing bid asks directly. You can start doing crawl nets where you can end up finding like all this intelligent data that people are willing to offer publicly on purpose, and create whole new ways of looking at those that probably lower the barrier to creating some of those networks.
Does it enable any nefarious uses?
You know, this to me, you know, as a libertarian, this is right there in the realm of the rights that we should have and that we shouldn't compromise on, regardless of whether there's a minority of maluse of those rights. And I think that, you know, any system could be used for bad. We had this adjudicated with a lot of the video recording, earlier video recording mediums. And, you know, the court decided like you can't remove someone's right to record video because someone could copy something from Blockbuster, right? And that's what this is. Like the 95% cases that people are doing amazing things with these decentralized identifier systems that better the lives of people and just do things we had never seen. And then there's going to be a fringe that use them for nefarious purposes. And I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the idea that we can speak freely and that we can own our identities. And you know, it comes with a little baggage, but liberty isn't free.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Is there any risks here that chain analysis will be analyzing the blockchain? Is there anything they can get from the blockchain here?
No. So the protocol that we're ION, the protocol that we've announced today, it's not really subject to chain analysis. Like you, there's nothing you could learn more on the chain than the actual identifiers that are out there on the decentralized storage medium, you know, that actually house the ops themselves. So, and there's no PII. I should be very clear about this. DID methods themselves contain no PII, no actual personal information. It's just decentralized public key infrastructure linked to IDs. All of the transaction of like verbose identity data, things that might identify you as a person or are sensitive to you, that takes place completely off chain in encrypted channels that are peer based. So they don't really have any data exposed like that to crawl.
It's interesting because it makes me think then why are Ethereum putting so much stuff on the blockchain?
Well, I don't. So in the Ethereum, I'm friends with a lot of people in the Ethereum community. I think there's some great people in the community. There's a diversity of opinions there too. I know people that absolutely try to minimize their use of all these chains regardless of what chain it is, and I personally believe that's probably the way to go, because you're going to be able to make a hell of a lot more scalable system the less you encumber these public networks.
Can you see experiences where people have actually linked the identifier to a wallet so the two go hand in hand, a bit like MetaMask?
Yeah, so I mean, it will be, I think that those are similar flows, right? Those are the tools that people need, right? It's how to control and do identity interactions with a tool that is right there in my browser, potentially like alongside me as I'm trying to log into places, that makes that a simple like inflow task where it's not taking me out and disrupting me. That's exactly the sort of UI and advancements we need, but probably even beyond just something like MetaMask, right? We probably gotta go. One thing specifically, we've been working on some interesting new cryptographic schemes for recovering secrets that have not had real implementations yet, that I think will make maybe a little bit better than mnemonics and Shamir. So those are ongoing activities. We're trying to really attack it at the lowest levels so that we can come up with the tools that could even support the realistic ability for normal people to maintain these IDs and use them.
Yeah, similar to with your crypto, if you lose your private key, you're going to lose that identifier you've created.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so that's why we are digging in, and you know, we're going all the way down to the level of cryptographic schemes and UX and really that entire stack that's presented to people so that they have something that makes this doable. Because I actually think that the decentralized identity layer, many components of it, are actually not that difficult compared with the UX of making it real for normal people to use. Like the UX is probably the number one challenge. And you know, we've got a lot of great UX folks that are working on this, but you know, you look out there in the crypto community, and I think we might be under investing in that. If we really want to take it to the next level, it's gotta be a hell of a lot easier than it is today.
Well, I've been highly critical of UX across anything cryptocurrency. I mean, there are exceptions. I think a company like Caso is very good at UX. You know, some people don't agree with me, but I actually think Coinbase is pretty good at UX. But there's a lot of tools out there that aren't great. I've always found MetaMask very difficult to use, and I would have thought most normal people, like my friends who haven't got any exposure to cryptocurrency, if you put them in something like in front of something like MetaMask, it's not going to be an experience they're going to understand or want to use. I feel like with what you're doing, I guess we can allow a certain additional amount of complexity because this is a beneficial tool to them. Privacy is important. So, but at the same time, it has to be super easy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll make a statement today with not pejorative, not against anyone, any of the communities, but like, I think we need to get leaps and bounds better in terms of UX. I don't think anyone is out there saying we have completely solved it. Grandma can use this thing. Yep. Like that is just not a statement I think anyone can make. And I don't think they could keep a straight face if they tried. But we have to collectively as a community get there. And I don't think it's Microsoft putting a monopoly UX experience out there that's the only one you should use. I think it's just us all figuring out the ways that speak to humans to manage these complex flows and reduce it to a level where yes, my mom can do that. So that's the cool part about having a consumer company like this that has these resources come on board, because they're going to tackle it with the same amount of rigor that we have to tackle everything else. Like we have really high standards for accessibility for folks who you know might be blind or deaf or you know those sorts of things. And so those needs are baked in from the start. Like we have to tackle Mount Everest, and that's like the min bar, right? Because we're a highly regulated company, have a lot of governments use our stuff. So we need to make sure that everything we produce is of that quality. And so that's our approach, and that's how we're going to tackle it.
And it was also quite interesting because I think we're getting closer and closer to a time where people cannot ignore cryptocurrencies, almost certainly cannot ignore Bitcoin. It's increasingly going to become a part of our life. And if you're creating tools such as what you're doing, that people are going to have to kind of step up and increase their knowledge.
Yes, I think that there's going to be some learning. I don't think we're ever going to get out of learning anything about it and being able to use it easily. But I do think that A, there's motivation, because if we can get really core proofs that the person uses in their daily life tied to something, it'll become sort of, you know, it's that muscle memory that you're building of how to use something. Yep. Maybe I show my mom how to do it, you know, and it's hard for the first week, but if she's using it frequently for, you know, valuable interactions, she's going to get it, right? Especially if we lower the bar enough. And I think that's the challenge, is how low can we get it that we bring enough people into the fold who are not technical that this thing starts a flywheel of motion. Because that's what really decentralized identity needs to survive, is that it needs enough people kind of operating in that web of trust to build that that benefit to everyone involved. And then it becomes something that's just inevitable.
Right. So how much can you tell me about the tech behind this, the tech stack? And you don't have to go into super complex detail, but what's involved in building this infrastructure?
So the Ion nodes themselves, it's actually a pretty simple system, right? It's a system that groups together operations. Like if you're running one at home, maybe it's just your operations. If you did that, you'd of course have to pay the full weight of a Bitcoin transaction. But if you signed your operations with keys you generated locally and sent them off to a node, what that node is going to do, whether it's at your house or the remote one, is batch them together, create a hash that's linked to an IPFS, that root node is obviously the holder of that initial data, exposes an IPFS and anchors it in the Bitcoin blockchain. All the other nodes essentially are looking for those hashes to come up in Bitcoin. And when they find them, they start requesting that hash's data in IPFS. And they usually it's going to be the originating node and whatever, you know, nodes it's circulated it to already. And they all pin it. So it's not this magical IPFS thing where just IPFS just stores all your, you know, 40 gig cap, you know, movies or something like that. It's specific, deliberate. They only look for these hashes. They store them, and all nodes that are full nodes replicate that data. It seems like it might be a lot of data, but it's not a crazy amount. I mean, if over 100 billion IDs in the system would be like 50 terabytes to have a full node. And you could resolve pretty instantaneously anyone on the planet. And there's obviously less than 100 billion people. So, and think about like for any company or organization or even like co-op or even a hobbyist of any seriousness, having 50 terabytes, which is like an end state many years from now when we've wildly succeeded, is probably not a lot. You know, I mean, like for us, for Microsoft, it's a rounding error. For any company that makes like a few million bucks a year, it's probably a rounding error. So, but there is another type of node, right? There's this light node. And that is a reduction of almost 100 to 1 in terms of data you need to store to trustlessly resolve IDs on the system. And that's, you know, that's small. I mean, you could have that same over 100 billion IDs and you'd have under 2 terabytes of data that you need to store. That's even possible on devices today. And I think that as storage grows, you know, things will get better on the cost perspective. So,
okay. Who will operate the nodes?
So right now we launched a few partners in our blog post. We've got Equinix, Casa, Cloudflare, Learning Machine, Civic is operating a node as well. And right now they're, you know, the commitment that we're hoping from them is to operate these full nodes and to make sure that the system is robust so that if they use the IDs or, you know, other people inject IDs in the system, that we'll have a network that starts to become highly replicated. And as time goes on, more nodes will be added. The cool thing about the protocol, though, is that you don't have to run a full node or even that light node to keep your IDs alive. Like, you're not dependent on Microsoft or anyone else. You could start a node up that just had the data for your ID state changes and offered that out to the world. And that would persist your ID information. Even if no one else cared about you on the entire planet, you could still persist that data. Now, I don't think in like theoretical economics that that's going to be the case. Like, a lot of people care about you. The world revolves around being able to authenticate your users and your customers. And businesses already put a ton of money into this, right? We have user databases and tables and redundancy and OAuth tokens and all this other stuff that people are willing to spend money on. So the concept that people, you know, companies are going to be turned off by, oh, I had to spend money to have a secure authentication system, I think is kind of ridiculous, right? We're not talking about the spinster's cap photos here. We're talking about like core proofs that enable you to do business with your customers. So that's why I think businesses will replicate this particular subset of data in the world.
But will individuals be encouraged to run their own?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And you don't need to run some heavyweight node to just persist your own data. That's something that, you know, we want to hope to build into wallets and other supporting services and apps that are on the devices people use today.
You know, somebody said to me recently that they envisage a future where we have like this magic box at home, which is our full node for Bitcoin. It has Tor, kind of has everything you need all built into one box. Can you see that scenario? And you could see identity being part of that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think that for various reasons and use cases over time, we've always tried to like put a box in the home, right?
Yeah.
The only successful one is probably video games, which now actually have, it's weird, they have had a lot of storage and power, and now they might start waning in streaming games, so like maybe you don't need as powerful box. But throughout history, there's always been like NAS systems and everything. I do think that we're going to get to a point where there's valuable digital information that you would want to keep in your quote-unquote safe, just like you used to keep your gold coins or your, you know, your deeds or any of those other really important documents in a safe. And I think that'll probably, as time goes on, become normal in human life.
Yeah, it'd be a real shift for people, though. This kind of sovereign individual, whether it's financial or data, it's going to take a real shift in people firstly trying, accepting, and migrating towards it. But it's super important.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, your digital footprint today is probably more valuable than the vast majority of you things you do in meat space. And I think as time goes on, that's only going to become increasingly the case. And so people have to look at this as, I'm protecting this digital property that I own just as much as I would, you know, protect cash in my safe or just, you know, anything of extreme value at my house. And over time, I think as we've seen more breaches and violations of people's privacy, I think people are going to get that because everyone's going to at some point be affected by identity theft and these just devastating losses in the digital realm. And the more that it happens, I mean, this isn't a positive thing, but the more that it happens, I think the more it forces people to think about, how do we get out of this situation, you know?
Yeah, for the future, for like my children, this is obviously something great. For myself, I'm like, oh God, I've got so much data out there already. I feel like once I have my decentralized ID, how do I go out there and clean up all my old data that I don't want out there? I mean, do I have to go to every website?
God, that's a great question.
Yeah, well, it crossed my mind on the way over. Because when I did it with Google, I moved to the Brave browser. I got rid of all my Google data and my experience degraded. I got used to things like, you know, when I'm in San Francisco and I do a search for a restaurant, I don't want it to default to London because I want it to know I'm in San Francisco. So I kind of had that realization, like I want them to have some of my data. But then I was thinking about this, thinking, God, I just want a fresh start. I want to wipe my records from the internet and start again.
God, you know, it's what's really crazy to think about is that, A, that is hard. Like, that's going to be so hard. Everyone you've ever interacted with, there's like zillions of tracking cookies on every web page. Someone's got something of yours no matter what, probably everywhere, right? Not to mention all the non-companies, like just individuals, hackers, everyone who probably has copies of all this stuff as well. So I almost feel like for us born today who have had our birth certificates minted already, like it's kind of like almost this Pandora's box. It's hard to put, you know, you can't close it. And you can't put the cat back in the bag. It's almost something like you said, for our children or the people that are to come, they will potentially, I hope, have the opportunity to start fresh, to say privacy is baked into my life by default. And the preservation of it is something that is inherent to these digital systems that were created by people who cared enough to do so.
Yeah. And I also think there is going to be a lot of opportunity for new businesses to create. So imagine companies who are spotting the opportunity to build privacy focused products that integrate with what you've created, like a category of experiences out there that are based where privacy is central.
Yeah, no, I think so. And so at first, I think it'll be people that are highly privacy conscious. You'll get all the early adopters. You know, it might be high net worth individuals. It might be cryptocurrency people. You know, there's people who do care about privacy today because it actually materially impacts their life. The average user, I think, is going to have a lot of carrots, like a lot of great things that they get as a result of having a decentralized ID that just make their life easier. So I think it'll come in phases. But it will help, I believe, to have a company like Microsoft that can reach a broad consumer audience to be there to kind of create that flywheel effect, to sort of start, prime the pump and get it moving. And that's honestly why I went to Microsoft to do this. You know, I worked at Mozilla. I proposed this in early 2012 under the moniker Firefox Handshake. And it was something at a time when they were working on Firefox OS, which sucked a lot of the money out of the company. So we didn't have an opportunity to do it. And I went to Microsoft specifically saying, where is the next place I'm going to go where I can make this a reality? And when you look at the ecosystem out there of large companies that have this consumer footprint, there's not a lot who are attuned for this message, for this technology, and to really bring it to the fore, whether it's because they might be incentivized otherwise or that's just not their business. But Microsoft is sort of in this state where it has the right incentives, it's got the right backing, it has the right footprint in the marketplaces. And so that's why I came to do it.
One of the things I found interesting, if we kind of roll back to when we first started talking, is you talked about deplatforming. And I guess it's a censorship-resistant login. Say we had some form of social media website that allows you to use a decentralized login. They wouldn't be able to prevent you from logging in and seeing the website, but I guess they would be able to associate you with an account.
Well, so they still could prevent you from logging in. If the service knows of a DID that they don't want to allow, they can say, I don't want to allow that. But again, you can mint pseudonymous identifiers, so you can create another one perhaps. But you're right, there's no magic bullet here. So if someone uses their DID just to log in, but then on the back end of that, you know, it's a traditional SQL database and they just map you over to like some, you know, graphic user, you know, user ID in their system. And then they tie all the data to that and they still have it in their central servers. Yeah, I mean, if they ever cut off access to that ID, they're essentially cutting off access to your data. So it's really important. And that's where that data store piece came in, where maybe there's apps in the future that, you know, instead of my to-do list app, which a certain company that I really love the utility of stores on their centralized servers, maybe the to-do list app is an app that is pushed down to my device. It asks for some identity permissions to my data store, and it treats my data store as its serverless infrastructure. So it's actually just calling some APIs. It doesn't know where my data store is. It could be on Microsoft, could be a static IP at my house, little freedom box. That's where it's actually storing its data. It doesn't even have its own AppDB. That's where I hope we go.
Yeah, and also, just came to my mind, if you are deplatformed for something like Facebook, your login to so many other websites has been deplatformed at the same time.
True. Yeah. Very true.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's profound. Deplatforming is... This is me speaking personally. I certainly don't want to speak on behalf of Microsoft or anything, but I think deplatforming is the wrong way to go. I think that it's trying to solve what it perceives as a problem in a way that degrades other rights of ours. And in the process, we'll probably lose a great many more. And so I think that, you know, Justice Brandeis talked famously about, you know, the best antidote to bad speech is more speech. It is not a reduction of speech. It's not exclusionary thinking, because that is going to balkanize people. It's going to, you know, crystallize them against your point of view. The best way is to just allow people to speak freely and disagree with them vehemently with ideas.
Have you talked to Andrew Torba?
Who's that?
The guy from gab.com, Andrew Torba.
Haven't had any conversations with them at all. You know, again, this is open source stuff though. Yeah. Anyone can use this. And we'd encourage, I don't care whether, a lot of people disagree with me, right? At work, in my personal life, I'm a libertarian, you know, we don't have the largest percentages representation in the world. So I'm used to that, but whatever part of the political spectrum you're on, even if I may disagree with you on certain points, I hope you embrace this technology because it's going to make your life better. And that doesn't care who's in the White House or who you vote for. It's just going to make your life better.
So when can we start playing with it?
So Ion, the thing we launched today, that's in a very early reference node state. It is runnable. It runs on Bitcoin testnet. The protocol is not fully implemented, so there's lots of features it talks about in other areas that just aren't there, things we need to harden. We chose, and I really encouraged Microsoft to come out and talk about this early, because we don't want to just, you know, bake something and then say, here, it's all done. You know, we would rather have people in there when there's rough edges, to welcome people to work with us and make sure that they had a hand in shaping it, instead of just saying, here's this you know, finished product and you should just use it. And that was the thinking. So there's tons of rough edges. You're going to hit snags and, you know, it's going to be tough. But over the coming months, we're going to get it ready for a mainnet release.
And has there been much of a reaction from others within the Decentralized Identity Foundation?
You know, we've worked with a great many partners in there. You know, ironically enough, some of the best thought and technical contributors to shaping this protocol and this work over time have been from the Ethereum community.
Right. Okay.
Especially Christian Lundqvist, formerly of Uport, and others. Chris Allen has, you know, I've talked to off and on throughout, you know, the last few years, bounced ideas off him. It's come from all over the landscape, all over the crypto ecosystem. So that is one thing I really value about this work, is that it's one area of the crypto ecosystem that I get into rooms and people aren't fighting about these underlying systems. For once, we just sit at a table and we talk about technical problems, and they might say, hey, I want to go, you know, anchor the base of my system here and there, but no one has to fight about that, because the cool part about decentralized identity is your choice. And we just want to make sure that people have that choice.
Cool. Okay. Well, a couple of things just to close out with. What's your kind of general feeling of Bitcoin at the moment?
You know, I still think it's in really early stages.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, the UX problem isn't solved. It's just as hard for identity. There's, you know, adoption needs to happen. We probably need to see more institutional players come in and do certain things to kind of broaden the base a little bit. I think it's a young technology. But if you look at the web, I mean, the web didn't really even get popular until sort of the mid to late 90s. and it'd been around for well over, you know, God, what is almost two decades, in some primitive form, right? Obviously not in consumer usable, but the theory of sending packets was there for a long time. I think that Bitcoin's going to follow a similar trajectory in the sense that it's going to take a while, and you know, we'll be there to help, but yeah.
Are there any other initiatives within Microsoft with Bitcoin? And then I'm going to put quote unquote blockchain.
Yeah, so in relation to Bitcoin, when I talk about like we're here to help, I mean me personally. I don't mean, you know, Microsoft, obviously. But I think there's limited things that we're working on. This is the only thing really that touches Bitcoin that we're working on right now. And that's because, other than accepting it for payment, I think in some other divisions, because these underlying systems are actually good at the thing we're trying to do, which is a chronological decentralized lineage, period. We don't have a lot of other uses for it right now. So I'm not actively engaged in it, and Microsoft isn't supporting any other initiatives I'm aware of with Bitcoin. But you know, we'll use it where it presents itself as a good solution.
Okay. And lastly, where can people find out more? Who do you want to hear from, and how can they get in touch?
So you can go ahead and, I mean, if you wanted to hit me up on Twitter, it's CSU Wildcat on Twitter. There's a website for decentralized identity on the Azure domain. So if you just like type in Microsoft decentralized identity, you'll get it. There's a great white paper that we did that's, you know, I think it's like 30 pages long. It describes this entire thing that you and I talked about, probably not even in as high technical detail, that can help really for non-technical folks, can get them into like what is the entire framework, like what is all this about. So that's where I'd encourage them to look. And then DIF as well, Decentralized Identity Foundation. It's identity.foundation. Tons of companies, competitors, everyone working together to make these open source standards.
Amazing. Well, listen, I'll share that all out in the show notes. Congratulations and thank you for coming on. And hopefully we'll do this again in the future, you know, once I've had a chance to play with a decentralized identity. And yeah, hopefully we'll catch up again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what did you make of that? What do you think of this initiative by Microsoft? I find it super exciting, actually. I find it really cool that Microsoft want to get involved in the world of Bitcoin. And I did initially have concerns that if companies start using the Bitcoin blockchain to write data to it, whether this is unethical, as Bitcoin should probably only be used for financial transactions. But having spoke to a couple of people after it, including Matt O'Dell, I'm less concerned now. As long as they pay the mining fees, then it appears that this is okay. I also find it super interesting that major companies are starting to look at Bitcoin. And I noticed this a lot this week in New York when I was here at Consensus. Like, as you navigate the noise of the space and all the nonsense projects, there is a lot of talk around Bitcoin. A lot of big companies are starting to look at it. So this is super cool. This is super interesting. But it was great to have the chat with Daniel. If you've got any of your own thoughts regarding this, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I'd love to hear from you. And also, if you want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. Doesn't matter whether you want to just leave me a review on iTunes or whether you want to become a sponsor. Everything helps with taking the show forward further. So here's how you can help. Firstly, just listen to the ads. It's the sponsors that enable me to do this. I've been out in New York now for just over a week, and I've managed to do 8 interviews, and doing them in person makes for a much higher quality. So give the sponsors a listen. You can become a patron if you don't want to listen to the ads. Just head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid for $5 a month. You can get the show without ads. If you don't want to use Patreon, you can subscribe to an ad-free version using crypto. Just drop me an email. I'll give you a deposit address and add you to the distribution list. You can become a show sponsor. I mean, all my ads are pretty much sold out for a few months, but planning ahead, if anyone is interested, then feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. You can leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. Both help with the show. You can follow me on social media. I'm @whatbitcoindid on everything, though I'm also @PeterMcCormack on Twitter. You can check out my website. That's whatbitcoindid.com. You can sign up to my newsletter and you can share the show out with your friends and family. Anyway, New York is done. I did the Magical Crypto Conference, also did Consensus. I've met a whole bunch of cool people. People I've not met before, people I met last year, new friends created, a couple of new enemies created, sorry. But I've got so many interviews done. I've got like 8 in the bag already for the next few weeks, which is super cool. Some great interviews coming up, so I can't wait to get them out for you. I'm heading back to London tomorrow. Thank you to everyone who I've hooked up with, had a drink with, had a coffee with. It's been really, really awesome to catch up with people here in New York. If you want to get in touch with me, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.